So what I'm going to talk to you about today is using influence, which is a concept that's related to correlated surprise. So essentially, we're going to try to understand complex systems by looking for components that do surprising things around the same time. And I'm going to start out by telling you a story about an autonomous vehicle named Stanley and a bug that Stanley experienced that caused him to swerve around obstacles that didn't exist. And in the context of telling you this story, I'm going to elucidate some of the characteristics of complex systems that are important for us and that apply to a wide variety of systems, ranging from clusters and supercomputers down to autonomous vehicles, as well as non-computational systems, such as traffic or biological systems. And I'm also going to talk, in the context of this Stanley bug, about the way we currently use dependency diagrams and other such techniques to try to diagnose these kinds of bugs, and describe a little bit how those fall short. And then I'll tell you the sort of cut to the chase and say what was causing this bug in Stanley, and how by using my technique, this technique of using influence, how you could come up with the root cause of this bug very quickly. Then I'll go into detail and explain to you exactly how you compute influence. And let me see whether I can get my presentation up now. All right, holding my breath here. Oh, fantastic. Okay. Then I'll explain to you the details of how you actually go about computing influence. And using that as a building block, I'll describe to you a query tool that we built called Chi that allows us to ask natural types of questions about complex systems. And that's going to take up about the first maybe two-thirds of the talk. And then I'll use the rest to describe case studies where we apply these techniques to real systems such as clusters and supercomputers and autonomous vehicles to answer various types of questions like doing root cause diagnosis, relating known problems to each other, and building models of systems. And then finally, I'll describe a recent extension to this work where we're able to do this analysis online for systems that contain hundreds of thousands of components. Okay, so first I promised you a story. So let's talk about Stanley. So this is Stanley, and I'm talking about the car, not the gentleman posing on the car. That's Sebastian Thrun up there, who was the lead for the Stanford racing team. And Stanley was an autonomous vehicle that won the DARPA Grand Challenge. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a second. So the point is that Stanley is a complex system, and he has a lot of the characteristics of complex systems that we care about. So there are feedback loops and cycles. Information doesn't just flow through Stanley from one end to the other. He has resource sharing, so different components will contend for resources like disks or bandwidth. There are components that are unknown, and they could be unknown because, for example, they're proprietary. And so even the racing team had no ability to look inside of those components and get instrumentation data out of them. And similarly, there are occasions where the interactions themselves are unknown. And finally, even on the components where they know a lot about them, it's clear that you can't log everything in a system. And even those things that you can log, you may not be able to log with a great deal of precision. So the instrumentation data coming out of systems, complex systems, especially Stanley, are very noisy and incomplete. So some components don't log anything at all. And other times, the components will create logs that have jitter in the timestamps, and sometimes just downright corrupt data. But despite all these characteristics, Stanley was a very successful system. So I said that Stanley won the DARPA Grand Challenge. So this was a $2 million prize. This is a car. I mean, you saw it was a Volkswagen Touareg, and it drove itself more than 100 miles through the desert with no one inside of it. So it figured out where the road was and went through mountain passes and did a very good job. Won lots of money. It's in the Smithsonian now. It's a great example of a very successful, very complex system. But Stanley was not perfect. So this is Stanley, the one in the front. And the car behind is a chase car. So the point of the chase car was that if Stanley, you know, goes rogue and just starts, you know, driving off, that in addition to someone sitting inside of the chase car with a kill switch, there's also a kill switch on the outside of Stanley, so that if the remote kill switch doesn't work, someone would chase Stanley down and jump up and smack the kill switch. Okay, and so this is the point where you can imagine the person in the chase car starts to get a little nervous, because Stanley just slowed down, and you can see there's nothing in front of him, jacked the wheel to the left, and starts driving up on the curb. So he's swerving around an obstacle, which you and I can tell doesn't exist. And the way the racing team described it in their journal article was that there were a total of 17 of these swerving incidents, nearly all of which occurred between mile marker 22 and 35 in the race, that led to the insertion of what they called phantom obstacles into the map. So let me describe to you exactly what happened, and then I'll tell you what traditional dependency-based techniques would say about how you should go about debugging this problem and why that was not an appropriate solution. And then I'll talk about how you use influence to find this exact same problem and do so much, much faster. Okay, so Stanley builds a model of his world by taking input from a bunch of sensors and saying, okay, well, if the lasers tell me what obstacles are nearby, and the IMU, which is the inertial measurement unit, tells me what my pose is, so things like the pitch and the yaw, then I use this and I say, okay, well, if I'm flat, and there's nothing in front of me, then I can proceed. Okay, so that's the decision that he would make here. But this race was out in the desert, and so the road was not flat. So every now and then, Stanley would go over bumps. This is obviously not to scale, hopefully. So every now and then, Stanley would go over bumps, and this would cause him to pitch forward, and his lasers would see the ground. And at that point, the lasers would say, there's an obstacle in front of you. But the IMU is reporting that Stanley is pitched forward. And so the model that Stanley builds of the world says that, well, that's probably just the ground that I see, because I know when I'm pitched forward that I see the ground. So he would make the decision to proceed anyway. And I should tell you a little bit more about exactly how Stanley is collecting these measurements. So the main software loop, it just goes in a continuous loop, and every iteration through, it goes and it grabs the most recent value that's been reported by each of the sensors. And now here's where the problem comes in. Every now and then, the laser sensors were not able to report their most recent measurements. And so this main software loop was picking up stale laser measurements. The IMU was updating properly, but the lasers were not. And so when these stalls occurred, the stale laser data would continue to indicate that Stanley was blocked. The IMU, on the other hand, would say, oh, you flattened out now. And this is what an obstacle looks like. This is the kind of obstacle that Stanley would need to decide to evade. And that's exactly what he was doing. He was hallucinating these obstacles and evading them like he was supposed to. So this is a really malicious bug. It has all of the characteristics that a bad bug would have. I've listed them here, or at least some of them. So the first is that it's implicit. So if you were to look at the code inside Stanley, there's nothing that says the laser data has to be sufficiently fresh, that says, oh, it can't be older than some amount of time. There were no checks for this. There was no enforcement of any sort of stale properties. And so there's no static analysis technique of this software that would have picked up on it. It just simply was not specified. It's a timing dependency, and timing dependencies are notoriously difficult for software analyses to deal with. Most of them don't even try to do anything like that. They'll deal with data dependencies and control dependencies, but if you say this has to happen within 5 seconds of this other thing, mostly we don't have a good way of describing that. It's non-deterministic. So Stanley didn't swerve every time he went over a bug, and he didn't swerve every time his lasers stalled out. You needed exactly this combination of characteristics. And in order to think of, oh, I should recreate these exact scenarios, you pretty much already have to understand what the bug was in order to recreate these circumstances. And what that means is that in order to diagnose this bug, you have to rely on the logs that were collected when the bug manifested itself. That is, the logs that were collected during the race. After the race, they drove Stanley around and they tried to get him to do it again, and it didn't happen. So they just had the logs, and that was their mechanism for trying to figure out this dependency bug. And using the dependency diagram, which was all that they had at the time, it took them 2 months to figure out that the lasers were likely to be involved in this problem. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what that approach is, how you use a dependency diagram. I'll show you Stanley's dependency diagram and show you exactly why this was a two-month process. So the typical approach is to use causal dependencies. And what I mean by causal dependencies is either a functional or a communication dependency. So a functional dependency would say, if A depends on B, that means that the correct operation of A depends on the correct operation of B. Whereas a communication dependency would be that A consumes data or information generated by B. And this is an appealing notion because it leads naturally to root cause. If I observe something bad coming out of A, I'll first look and make sure that A is OK. And then I'll chase the dependency arrows backward. And I'll look and see whether B is doing the correct thing. And if B is doing the correct thing, I'll chase the dependency arrows pointing to B and so on. And the way you get these dependencies in the first place is typically using either manual specification. You get someone who really knows the system and who's really smart to sit down and think about it and draw you a picture and say, here you go. Or some sort of a system modification to get the system to write down whatever information is necessary for you to infer these dependencies. So things like recording every time B sends a message to A. And I've listed a few projects that have done this sort of thing, like Pinpoint, Pip, Magpie, Project 5, D3S, and there are a whole bunch of others. But there are some problems with dependency-based approaches. The first is a definitional problem. So what constitutes a dependency? If you have two components that are contending for a resource, would you say that those two components depend on one another? Most techniques don't. Most techniques would not say that those two components, which are those circles are components, by the way. They would not say that those two components depend on one another. But certainly, especially if there's a lot of contention for this resource, those components can influence each other's behavior. Either if one of them starts using more of that resource than he's supposed to, or even if he starts using less of that resource. And forgive me for anthropomorphizing components. If that component uses less of that resource, it can also influence the behavior of the other component. I said one of the ways that we get these dependencies in the first place is to have someone smart sit down and write them. But any complex system of any significance is changing on a day-to-day basis. And so you then have the question of who maintains these dependency diagrams. If you infer it, you have to ask the question of how it's measured. So is it expensive to record the kind of measurements that would allow you to infer causal dependencies? If you went inside of Facebook, for example, and you said, I want you to create a log entry anytime one machine sends a message to any other machine, or anytime a component inside of that machine requests information from any other component inside of that machine. Clearly, that would be untenable. But there's a fundamental problem also with dependencies. And that's what you do about discontinuities, that is, portions of the system from which you have no information. So a dependency-based technique can't tell you anything about the relationship between the component on the left side of that cloud and the component on the right side of that cloud. And I don't mean a cloud in the sense of cloud computing. I mean a cloud in the sense that we don't have any logs or any instrumentation data from some portion of the system. And so we can't talk about the dependency relationship between these two. So I'm beating this horse dead because this is dependency-based techniques have been around for a very long time. So I want to be really clear about why this was the wrong approach and why in many cases it is the wrong approach. So this is the dependency diagram for Stanley. And this was done by the really smart guy approach. So the racing team built this dependency diagram. They wrote it down. This is, if you were trying to do dependency inference, this would be the gold standard that you would compare yourself against. So the swerving bug is kind of off the plot to the right side, maybe to the right of vehicle interface. It's kind of hard to see. It's a big diagram, right? There's a lot going on here. But the swerving would happen sort of somewhere off to the right there. And so they looked at the Toreg interface, and they made sure that that was behaving according to specification. As far as they could tell, it was. And so they chased those three dependency arrows backward, and they looked at the components that those led to. And those seemed to be behaving according to specification. And they continued this exponentially expanding process of following dependency chains backward and checking whether these things were behaving according to spec. And eventually, they made it down to the lasers, which are actually on the entire other side of the system. But it wasn't actually the lasers that were stalling. In fact, it was a buffer that the lasers were communicating with the rest of the system through. So in fact, the component that was ultimately responsible, this proprietary hardware buffer, is not even represented in the dependency diagram that they drew. So what do we do instead? Well, instead we use influence, which is statistical correlation. And specifically, it's statistically correlated surprise. We're looking for components that are doing surprising things around the same time. This is an orthogonal notion from dependencies. First of all, we can capture implicit interactions, such as contention for shared resources. And because we're using correlation, we can jump over those clouds. So even if you don't know what's going on in between two components, if the two components have correlated surprise, then you can talk about the influence relationship between those two components. Because of its statistical underpinnings, influence is a robust notion. So you can, as it turns out, do things like perturb the timestamps of your logs or drop messages at random and still be able to pick up on the influence. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. If you are interested, we have papers where we do extensive simulations and demonstrate this rather extensively. Okay, and the last is that influence understands time. So I said before that if you were writing down these dependency diagrams, you'd have to have some mechanism of maintaining them because systems are always changing. Well, influence can pick up on the way systems change over time. We can look at the way that influences will change, and I'll show you an example of that later. But there's another notion, or another sense in which we can capture time in our influence descriptions, which is that you can have delayed influence. Surprising behavior on one component can be followed sometime later by surprising behavior on another component. They don't have to happen at the same time. Okay. So let's try to use influence now, and I'm sort of going to treat this as a magic technique for two slides, and then I'll go back and tell you exactly how it works. Let's try to use influence to diagnose this Stanley swerve bug. So the only clue that the racing team had when the race ended was that most of the swerving behavior was happening between mile marker 22 and 35, which as it turns out was about 60 and 100 minutes into the race. And the question that they're trying to ask is what components and interactions are likely to be involved with this swerving behavior. So this is sort of the input. You give the raw logs and this clue and ask this question to our system, and it draws the picture that is the sort of salmon-colored subset of this graph. And it's actually not a subset. It's actually disjoint from the dependency diagram. And what it says was that the lasers seem to be exhibiting surprising behavior around the same time. And I suspect that this implies that there is some shared resource. When I see that surprising behavior, it's followed a short time later by surprising behavior in the planning software. And that's followed a short time later by this swerving behavior in a statistically consistent way. And you'll notice that when you compare this influence graph to the dependency diagram, that, as I said before, they're disjoint. So all of the arrows that were in the dependency diagram were irrelevant for finding this bug, and the influence arrows are not represented in them at all. Okay, so how do we actually compute influence? So it's three steps. The first is that we identify surprising behavior on individual components. We then correlate this surprising behavior in time and space. So we look for components that are doing this around the same time. And we summarize these influences as a graph. So I'm going to walk through this process now. So the signal of surprise over time we call anomaly signals. And the way you get an anomaly signal from raw measurements is by using some component model. Now, component models and anomaly signals are a powerful abstraction because they allow you to compare heterogeneous components. So you can talk about the influence relationship between a disk and a network link. It's also powerful because into your component model, you can roll in a lot of expert knowledge. So if you know, for example, that a particular spike in one of these anomaly signals was caused by spilling beer on a server, then you can say, oh, ignore that. I know what the cause of that spike was. Don't include that in the analysis. In this talk, we're not going to build any expert knowledge into the component models. We're going to assume that you don't know anything about what these signals mean, that basically the raw measurements are just a bunch of symbols. When those symbols are numeric, we're just going to use those numbers directly as the anomaly signal. So we're just going to say that deviation from average is surprising. If they're symbolic, like system logs, for example, we're just going to use bag of word style algorithms that just say that less common message terms are more surprising than more common message terms. And that's the extent of what we're going to do for component models in this talk. But this is an opportunity if you want to build in a lot of expert knowledge. And you'll see some hints as to how you can do that a little bit later and, by asking certain types of questions. But so nothing fancy is going on at the anomaly signal level. OK, so you do this, and now you get a bunch of anomaly signals. And my understanding is that this is actually kind of a familiar view to a lot of system administrators, that you use your screen real estate to lay out a bunch of graphs. And then you try to look for, based on what you know about what these signals usually look like, you try to look for either surprising things or patterns. So you might say, OK, well, I noticed that these different symbols or these signals seem to be spiking around the same time. And this is all Stanley's anomaly signals, by the way. You may look a little harder and then say, OK, well, maybe there's something changing in the system at some point, and I notice it on those two and maybe on some other ones too. But then there are others that are a little bit more subtle, and it's not clear whether we should actually say that it's significant, because there's a spike in those two, but maybe that's just a coincidence, right? So what we want is a way to automatically compute and represent these patterns. And the way we'll do that is using the standard notion of statistical cross-correlation. Okay. So I put up the equation for completeness, but all we're doing here is looking at sliding dot products. So we're just trying to see whether two anomaly signals line up especially well if we offset them by some amount of delay. And this is what a cross-correlation function looks like. So you have delay on the x-axis, and that's how much you've shifted these anomaly signals relative to each other, and correlation on the y-axis. So that extrema right there means that at some delay, these two anomaly signals line up very well. They're strongly correlated. And this is a pairwise relationship. So one natural way to summarize it is using a graph. So let's say that this is the cross-correlation between component I and component j, which again we'll represent as circles. And for some sufficiently strong correlation, we might draw an edge between the two. And you don't need to specify this threshold a priori, and you'll see why later. And then if that extrema also falls outside of some noise margin, then we might make this edge directed. And what that means is that if it falls within that noise margin, then they seem to be happening roughly simultaneously to within the precision of our timestamps. If it falls outside of that noise margin, then we think that there is actually some delay associated with this effect. And so once we have this, we would say something like surprising behavior on I seems to be followed a short time later by surprising behavior on J. They share an influence. They share a delayed influence. And we call a graph like that a structure of influence graph, or a SIG. So I'm going to say SIG a lot during this talk. The way you read a SIG is that there's one vertex per component, and the edges summarize the cross correlations. So here's an example of a SIG. And the way you'd read it is that adjacent components share an influence, so fan 7 precedes disk 32 in terms of its surprising behavior, but fans 6 and 7 seem to exhibit surprising behavior at roughly the same time. You'll also notice over there there's a different shaped box. And I wanted to draw your attention to this. It says job failures. And the point I want to make there is that anything you can represent as an anomaly signal, you can represent in your SIG. You can talk about the influence relationship between anything that has an anomaly signal. So if you were, for example, to write down when you observed some job failures, you can create an anomaly signal out of that and now talk about the relationship between those job failures and all the components in your system. There's also meaning that you can get from graph structure. So it's been our experience that if you see a clique in your graph, this is a good indication that there's probably some shared resource that is influencing the behavior of all of those components. And frequently, that's some uninstrumented component. I mentioned before that influence is a robust notion. We did a lot of controlled simulations that I won't talk about today. I think real systems are really interesting, so I wanted to talk about those instead. But we did a lot of controlled simulations. And the upshot of these simulations is that influence propagates under a wide variety of adverse conditions. You can do things like drop messages at random, add timing noise, do all sorts of malicious things, taint your training data, and so on. And not only does influence continue to propagate even when your logs are very noisy and very incomplete, but this SIG method can detect it. OK, so that gave us some confidence to actually try this with real systems. But first, we had an obstacle we needed to overcome, which is that even though this is a very good building block, if you were to use it naively on a very large system, it would fall down. And the reason is because what I've said so far is that you compute the cross-correlation between pairs of components. And so this is an order n squared operation. So the first problem that we had to tackle was one of scalability. So we built a query tool that we call Qi for querying influence. I've been chastised for not just calling it influence querying because they thought IQ sounded better, but I went with Qi. So there we go. So the first thing I'll talk about is how we use Qi. This is this query tool to deal with the scalability problem. And then talk about how you can also use these same queries to add and modify anomaly signals and how this is a mechanism to represent a lot of natural questions that you might want to ask. And finally, Qi provided a way to give some flexibility into the visualization of the structure of influence graphs. So you can do things like say, I want the thickness of the edge to represent the strength of the correlation and that sort of thing. So if you think about what we're doing when we compute cross correlations, we're filling out this influence matrix. So this is a square matrix that's indexed by the components in both directions. And every time we compute a cross-correlation, we can fill in two of these entries. And each of these entries contains cross-correlation or correlation and delay. And so one of the entries will correspond to the strongest correlation with a positive delay, and the other entry will correspond to the strongest correlation with a negative delay. So the first thing we can do is very explicitly say that we only care about some sub-portion of this graph, some sub-matrix. And so we do that by specifying a focal set. So if our focal set consisted of those four components, then we would only need to compute the cross-correlations that let us fill in these salmon-colored boxes, basically six cross-correlations. We might also then want to say that we want to know the influence relationship between that set of components and another set of components, but we don't yet care how that second set of components influence each other. And you specify that by giving a peripheral set. So if your focal set, again, is these three components here, and the peripheral set is all of the components except for maybe that last one, then you would compute the cross-correlations that fill in this cross-shaped portion of the matrix. Okay. Now, for a small matrix like this, it's difficult to maybe see why this is such a win. But for many natural kinds of questions that you want to ask, this takes the problem from order n squared to order n. Okay. And you'll see lots of performance numbers from real systems. But in addition to just saying which cross-correlations, which components specifically we care about the relationships between, there are other questions we might want to express. So we might want to express the idea of all of the nodes in a rack or some other aggregate behavior. And frequently, this might correspond to a subsystem. So you might say, I want to ask a question about the routers in my system. Or I want to ask a question about all of the nodes that are at the top of my rack because I have a question related to the way heat is being distributed or something similar. And the way we do this is using what we call metacomponents. So the anomaly signal of a metacomponent is just the average, the literal time average, of the anomaly signals of all of the constituent components. So if you wanted to talk about all the nodes in a rack, you would simply create a metacomponent whose anomaly signal is the average of all of the nodes in that rack's anomaly signals. Another concept you might want to express is some predicated question, like when the log contains a specific string, such as the error string. So this is an indicator signal. And the anomaly signal here would be high if some predicate is true and low otherwise. We call these binary components. So this graph is an example of what a binary component's anomaly signal might look like. So you have time on the x-axis and the value of surprise, if you will, on the y-axis. And so those places where the anomaly signal is high is those places are those places where the error string was present in the logs. And you can imagine, if you know a lot about what these logs contain, you can make these predicates arbitrarily complicated. You may also want to say something like, ignore the morning reboot. There may be portions of the signal that you would like to hide from the analysis. I gave earlier the sort of tongue-in-cheek example of spilling beer on the server, but maybe ignoring the morning reboot is a little more apropos. So you can use binary components as masks. So you can say something like, I want to discuss the behavior of node 7, but only when it was generating the error message, or something similar. And the resulting component is what we call a masked component. So all in all, we have these synthetic components that allow us to talk about things like aggregate behaviors, to ask hypothetical questions. What if that component did exactly what it did before, except there wasn't that weird morning behavior, and so on. Excuse me. And otherwise manipulating signals. And we do it all using this anomaly signal abstraction, either by taking existing components or by creating new components out of additional information, such as a specification of when jobs seem to be failing and so on. OK, so let me tell you what a query looks like. So I'm going to describe this query from right to left. So on the right, we have a regular expression. And the thing furthest to the right is always specifying the focal set. So in this case, the components that are in focus are those that match whose names match this regular expression caret R3, so they start with R3. The meta components are going to be in the periphery. So perif equals, unsurprisingly, is specifying the peripheral set. And meta is a keyword that matches exactly the meta components. Okay? So this might, for example, match all of the racks in aggregate, or the individual racks aggregate behavior. Okay. And top equals 5 says that I only want to create a sig that shows me the 5 strongest influences. And this is an example of how you don't have to specify some correlation threshold a priori. So going back to a picture of that influence matrix I was showing before, if the components matching, starting with R3, are those 3 there, and the meta components are, for some reason, almost all the other components in your system, then you would do the cross-correlations that let you fill in these entries. Okay? And that's what this query is telling our system to do. That's what Qi will do. The good news is that this is an embarrassingly parallel task. So you can compute every cross-correlation independently of every other cross-correlation. So the only reason that these taper off is because we weren't asking big enough questions. So if you give them bigger and bigger problems, you get basically linear scaling, which is great. Okay. So really, the way that you make these queries fast is by reducing the sheer number of cross-correlations that you're computing. And the way we do that is using these queries. So before I go and talk about the case studies, I want to be very clear about what we're requiring of systems that you apply this to. And I want to be clear about this because a lot of the existing work that you find in the literature has requirements that are rather strong. So they might require things like having access to the source code of all of the components in your system, or having logs that describe message paths through the system, and so on. So this is what our requirements are. So first, we need named components. So your components have to have a name. And this is basically a syntactic requirement, because in order to ask queries, you have to have something to write down. The components, some subset of the components, need to be generating timestamped measurements. We don't require that all the components generate these timestamped measurements. And we don't have any requirements on what those measurements are, except that you have to have some sort of a component model to create anomaly signals out of that. And I've said before, if these measurements are numeric, then you can just use them directly if you like. If they're symbolic, there are lots of simple statistical techniques that allow you to get anomaly signals. But if you like, you can have very strange types of measurements. And as long as you have some component model to create anomaly signals out of it, you're fine. It's been our experience so we've done this with probably a dozen different types of systems now. And it's been our experience that the generic defaults work well. If you're not happy with that, there's a field of anomaly detection and lots of opportunities to build in your expert knowledge. And that's all I'll say about that. OK, so let's talk about case studies. So here are some applications of using influence. And next to each of the applications, I have the name of a system, or I guess the type of the system in one case, that I'll show you an example of applying Qi to. So in all of these cases, when I talk about these examples, these are unmodified systems. We didn't perturb them or add instrumentation or anything like that. We simply went to the system administrators and we said we would like to have the logs from the system so we can analyze them. And then we were able to come back and do all these applications. Okay? So the first thing you might want to do is try to isolate problems. So this is just the standard root cause diagnosis. If you have problems that you already know about, you might want to relate them to each other. You might want to know whether one problem is in some way related to this other problem. You can ask hypothetical questions to rule out potential causes. So you may think that you know what the reason for something happening was, and so you can ask those sorts of questions. You may not have a question to ask, in which case you can just build a model of your system that will show the influence relationships among the components. And finally, I mentioned before that influence has an understanding of time and how influence changes over time. So you can also observe the dynamics of a system. And I'll use Junior, which is Stanley's successor, to talk about that. OK. So BlueGeneL, most of you, I guess, might be familiar with. BlueGene was at one point the fastest supercomputer and actually held the title for a while on the top 500. It's a production supercomputer at Lawrence Livermore that has more than 131,000 processors. Full disclosure, I was part of the system software team for BlueGeneL, so I have a certain affinity for this computer. And when I talk about failures on these systems, I'm in no way insinuating that these are broken systems. And I think as sysadmins, you understand that very good systems will still have problems. Okay, my disclaimer. All right, so at one point, BlueGene was experiencing full system job crashes. So in a full system job, ostensibly, every component in the system is involved with running it. So initially, every component is a suspect. And the only clue that the administrator had initially was the approximate time of the crash. So the administrator told us the approximate time of the crash, gave us the logs, and we threw them into Qi. And so we asked the question. So what we're doing here is creating a synthetic binary component whose anomaly signal is high exclusively during the interval that the administrator told us they saw this crash between hour 174 and hour 175. And you'll notice that's really poor granularity, okay? So it was like around this hour is pretty bad, okay? And we're going to name it crash. So crash now is this anomaly signal. And that single component is going to be in focus. In the periphery, we're going to have all of the meta components. So it turns out that components in BlueGene are named in a very beautiful hierarchical way. And so it's very easy to create these meta components. And so we did create one for each rack of BlueGene. So meta is matching each of the racks. And we're just going to look for the strongest influence. So what this is literally saying is compute the cross-correlation between the anomaly signal representing this crashing behavior and the anomaly signal for each of the 64 racks in BlueGene and tell me which one is the strongest. And less than 2 seconds later, you get back this sig, which I guess is maybe a little small. Hopefully you can see what's going on. And it says that rack 3 shares the strongest influence. And we say, cool. Let's recurse. Okay, so now we ask a similar question, which is we again use crash as the component that's in focus. And in the periphery now, we're going to match this regular expression R03, which turns out matches exactly those components that are part of rack 3. And now we'll just ask for the top 5, just to be interesting. And less than 5 seconds later, you get the following sig. And I'm using a little bit of graphical shorthand here. So anytime you see one of these gray boxes with an edge attached to it, that means that there's a similar edge attached to each contained vertex. And this is just to make the graphs a little bit less cluttered. And I've drawn this so that the component with the strongest influence is up there on the top. Okay, and this is some compute card of node 6 of midplane 1 of rack 3. And that's the according to Qi and these two questions we've asked, which is just which rack is the most suspicious? Okay, inside of that rack, which component is the most suspicious? That's the most suspicious out of more than 131,000 components. I should say, excuse me, it's the most suspicious out of that many processors. There are, of course, many, many more components, if you like. So there are millions of components. But we're just talking about those that actually generate logs. So what does it mean? So it fingers this particular compute card. Well, it turns out that around the time of the crash, there were 90 different components that generated hundreds of messages. This suspect node, on the other hand, generated exactly 2 messages. And it turns out that one of those messages was an alert message. And it was this, the following alert message, which basically says there's a memory error. Okay, so there's some memory that you probably need to replace. It turns out this was the only alert message that was generated during the period surrounding the crash. And it was an alert message that the administrator was unaware was ever being generated by the system. So he was simply unaware that this message existed. Excuse me. But so our technique came back and it said, these are the 2 messages that seem likely to be somehow related to the crash. And he looked at it and he said, oh, well, yes, that definitely means that there's some corrupt memory. And we convinced him to help us look through these hundreds of messages and confirm that, in fact, this was the only message that's likely to say anything about why these jobs were crashing. Okay. So you may also want to relate known problem types to each other. So memory errors are a good example of errors that you're not going to fix a bug and cause it to go away. They're going to continue coming up. But you might want to know whether those memory errors are related to any other problems that you're experiencing. So now let's look at the Liberty supercomputer, which is sort of way on the other end of the spectrum in terms of scale. So by most standards, this is like a GPU now. So it had 512 processors. At one point, it was on the top 500. It's long since been kicked off. And there were 14 known types of alerts in the Liberty logs. And these were identified in collaboration with Sandia and the administrators there. So we have these 14 alert types. And so we'll create some synthetic components, some alert components, that represent what we know about these alert types, namely when they're happening. So I said before that we have the ability to have these predicated anomaly signals, these binary components. And so we'll create some for these alert types. So we'll create one for each alert type that says that's high exclusively when that alert type is being generated by any component in the system. And then another set of anomaly signals that are high when each particular component is generating each particular type of alert. So we'll have an anomaly signal, for instance, that says when node 7 is generating the error alert. And now we can ask questions about these anomaly signals, about these alerts. So alert will be it's a keyword that matches exactly those alert components that we created. And just for trying to be a little bit complete and show you the other types of flags that you can specify, edge equals 0.1 is explicitly specifying what the correlation threshold is. So if the correlation is greater than 0.1, we want to plot it in this case. So about a second later, you get the following graph. And what this SIG is telling you is that it seems like these 3 EXT alerts and those 2 parity alerts are sharing an influence. So you might then want, so this is an interactive thing, so you might then want to ask, are these actually redundant? Is there any information that we get out of one of these EXT errors that we don't get from the others? So we can ask that by using another keyword, last, which says which matches those components that were plotted in the previous SIG. So it'll be those 5 components from the previous SIG in focus. And in the periphery, we'll have any component that matches this EXT string. Okay. So we run this, and 1 second later, it shows us this picture. And the picture says, in fact, no, those EXT alerts are not redundant. There are at least these 3 occasions on node 176, 133, and 134 where this EXT CCISS error is happening independently of the other 2 EXT errors. And on node 176, it also seems to be happening around the same time as these parity errors. Okay. So you can also use Qi to ask hypothetical questions. So there were some known issues on the Spirit supercomputer, which is another Sandia supercomputer about twice the size of Liberty. And the administrator observed some what he called strange behavior on SN138. So one question you might want to ask first is that node alone? So it's possible that the administrator noticed it on one node even though it was happening on other nodes. And so we can ask the question like this. We can say, put node 138 in focus. In the periphery will be all of our normal components, meaning not meta components or alert components or any of the synthetic ones, just the ones that were generated directly from the raw data. And we'll look at, arbitrarily, let's say, edge being 0.25. Okay? And I'm just sort of showing you what some of these flags look like. And a couple of seconds later, you get this sig that says there was, in fact, one other component that seems to be exhibiting strange behavior around the same time as this node that you're suspicious of. So the administrator knows about a lot of the problems that recur in these sorts of systems. And so he might want to ask whether any of the known alerts explain this shared influence. So you can do this by using masked components. So we can, and the syntax here, don't worry about too much. What we're saying here is that I want to talk about the behavior of node 138, except I want to mask out the places where node 138 was generating this PBS check error. Okay, so you take node 138's anomaly signal, and wherever this PBS check error was being generated, you squish them out so that they don't contribute to the cross-correlation. And now we have a new anomaly signal, and that's going to be in focus, and we're going to compute the cross-correlation between that and all of the other normal components. And a couple of seconds later, you get out the sig that basically says it doesn't seem like that PBS check error is the reason for this shared influence, because even when we mask it out, you still have the shared influence there. So let's try another one. Let's try this EXTCCISS error, which you may remember from a few slides ago. And a couple of seconds later, you get out this sig that says, in fact, yes, it is likely that this EXTCCISS error is the cause of this shared influence. And you learn something else, which is that by masking out this particular alert, you've revealed these previously obscured interactions between node 138 and these other nodes. It turns out that this CCISS error is extremely verbose. It generates literally millions of log messages within very short periods of time after it occurs. And so it creates a very, very large spike in the anomaly signal. And so when you mask that out, suddenly surprising behavior that maybe wasn't as surprising compared to this particular alert, now you can see, and now you can see how it relates to these other components. Okay, so that's how this hypothesis testing works. Sometimes you may not have a specific question that you want to ask. You simply want to be shown a picture of the influences in your system. So we collaborated with an administrator in the Stanford mail servers. And this is just obviously a very small portion of the cluster. So we just took these 17 machines that represented sort of a subsystem that he cared about. And each of these machines were generating two different kinds of logs. One was a sort of standard mail log, and the other was a spam filtering log. Just for the sake of completeness, it turns out that one of these machines was not recording the filtering log for some reason. It was broken, I guess. I don't know. But so we had not quite twice 17 logs. Okay, so we're just going to use the keyword all, which matches, unsurprisingly, all of these components. We're going to look at the top 47, because that's what fits on my slide. And we have now this error flag, which lets you specify that noise margin that I told you about before. So what this means is that if the delayed influence seems to be happening by more than a minute away from zero delay, then we'll make the edge directed and say this seems to be a delayed influence. And so you can see that there are some cliques here. So we show this to the administrator, right? And we say, what does this mean to you? Is this interesting? What does this say? And it sparked a back and forth conversation that went on for a few weeks. It turned out that this led us to isolate a problem that he had been experiencing for months and wasn't able to get any leads on because of the location of particular nodes in here and their delayed influence with other things. And so I'm not going to tell you that whole story. The upshot was that the administrator said this was really useful information. And so that's going to be, you know, the in lieu of any sort of quantitative measurement for whether this is a useful thing, I'll just quote the admin for the system. So I said that influence can change over time, and this is true even in static systems. So let's talk about Junior. So Junior was the successor to Stanley. You can understand why I'm so inclined to anthropomorphize Stanley, because he even has a kid. So Junior participated in the DARPA Urban Challenge, which was the follow-on to the DARPA Grand Challenge. Junior came in second place. And even though Junior was not modified during the race, which is, you know, clear from his dependency diagram, which also doesn't change during the race, it turns out that the influences did change. So this is basically a diff between the structure of influence graph that's generated using logs from the first mission of the race, the first third of the race, and the structure of influence graph generated using logs from the second mission of the race. So the dashed edges are those that disappeared between the first and second mission. It's kind of hard to see. I probably should have made it in color. But the thicker edges mean are edges that showed up during the second mission that were not there in the first. The open arrowheads mean that the directionality of the influence changed, and so on. Okay. So the point here is that even in a physically static system, where you haven't modified the software explicitly, you haven't added or removed hardware, the influences can still change. And that can be as a result of workload changes or external changes. And I want to briefly deviate and tell you a story that I think is really neat about another example of something that changes dynamically in a system. And this is in Stanley. So in Stanley, as it turns out, there was a temperature sensor. And one of the questions that we were asking about the system for an unrelated issue caused us to see that there was this shared influence between some surprising behavior that was happening late in the race and this temperature sensor. So we wondered why this would be true. And so we went in and we looked at the anomaly signal for the temperature sensor. And it was really erratic, but it was going up over time. Okay? So this was kind of surprising because the way that we generated the anomaly signals for Stanley was that we wiped out everything in the log except for the timestamps, and we just asked, how regular are those timestamps? What's the distribution of these inter-arrival times? And that's how we got these anomaly signals. So what that meant when the anomaly signal was increasing gradually over time was that, in fact, the timing at which these temperature sensor readings were being reported was becoming more erratic over the course of the day. So this was a race in the desert that started just around sunrise. And so over the course of the day, it went from, I was there. It was really cold before sunrise. And it got really hot by the end of the race. So it turns out that you can actually tell what temperature it is by measuring the timing of these temperature sensor measurements and not even looking at what temperature it was recording. Okay. So I thought that was kind of neat. But so this is true of lots of systems where the behavior that you see will change over time, even in ways that maybe you didn't explicitly cause. Okay? So the fact that we can capture these dynamics is important. So just a quick study, a summary of these case studies before I go to the online analysis. These were, as I said before, all production systems. These were unmodified. We didn't perturb them or instrument them in any way. We used generic component models. So as I said, with Stanley, we actually wiped out like all of the log content except for the timestamps. So we're basically doing kind of the easy, dumb thing with these component models. So there's a lot of opportunity to build intelligence into there and get even better results. Nevertheless, we were able to use this to find tough bugs, including things like implicit timing dependencies, revealed interesting interactions, and the feedback from the administrators of all of these systems has universally been that this is really useful. Okay? And as you've seen, it's fast enough to be interactive. So I showed you queries for systems with hundreds of thousands of components that take a couple of seconds to execute on a 22 machine cluster. So that's what we're using to compute these queries. So that's, by industry standards, I think, pretty small. Okay. And these were old machines, too. Okay. So let me talk a little bit now about an extension to this work. So this was an offline query tool that's an online analysis. So I won't go into the details, because I'd like to tell you a couple of results using this online analysis and get to questions. But the short version is that, again, we take a bunch of anomaly signals. We pass it through an online analysis that finds groups of signals, these behavioral subsystems. So you can think of these as anomaly signals and components that are correlated with no delay. So they seem to be doing things around the same time. And from that, we get out a smaller number of signals. And then we compute their lag correlations. So you might get out, for example, that RAC 5 seems to be doing something as a whole around the same time. And so that would be one of the group signals that stage one comes out with. And then we might find that there is a delayed correlation between the behavior of RAC 5 and the disk subsystem, for instance. And you'll notice that there's also a box for Qi queries. So now these become standing queries as opposed to interactive ones. So you ask questions and let it run for a while and then come back later and see what the answer was. OK. So it turns out that the algorithms that we use for this are very scalable. So we're able to use this for systems with hundreds of thousands of components. It turns out in a very specific quantitative way that these behavioral subsystems summarize the behavior of these systems very well. And in an online context, this delayed influence now enables us to do prediction. And that's what I'll talk about for a couple of minutes using two examples. So first, just on one slide, I'm going to remind you of the Stanley example and say, well, what if we could have detected this online? So this is essentially a failure cascade. Something weird was going on with the lasers, followed by something on the planners, followed by the swerving behavior. What if we could have detected online when these laser measurements were stalling? Okay, is that information actionable? So it turns out that in Stanley's case, it is, and it's a very easy fix, which is Stanley should just stop. So it's a transient problem. And if he just stops whenever he notices these anomalies, then that would have passed, and he would have avoided this swerving behavior that nearly cost him the race and cost the racing team $2 million. Okay, so that was the actionable information that if this had been an online analysis running during the race, we would have had a remediation strategy. Okay, but let me give you an example from a cluster. And this is... I like this example a lot. Okay, so this was a very small 9-machine SQL database cluster. And each of the machines were recording a large number of numerical metrics. And these are the metrics that you're probably all familiar with. So how many threads were there? How many forks were there? How many disk swaps were there? And so on. And we're just going to use these numerical metrics directly as the anomaly signals. So surprise means deviation from the mean. And there was a bug in this database cluster that would cause some machines to occasionally slow down and hang over a long period of time. The administrator would notice that they started to get slower and slower and then would eventually hang and couldn't figure out what was going on. So this clue is, this is quoted from an email that the administrator sent to us along with these logs. He said, the main time when we had the problem was Tuesday between 6:30 p.m. to Wednesday at 12:22 a.m., and another incident the following morning, 10 a.m. or so, I think. Okay, so that's the clue that you start with and have to come up with an explanation for this problem. So we run it through our online analysis. We give the online analysis exactly that clue, so an anomaly signal that's high exclusively during that period. And it comes out, stage one comes out and says, it seems like these two metrics, this disk and forks metric, seem to be strongly correlated. And when I see surprising behavior in that subsystem, I then see surprising behavior in this swap metric, followed by this crashing behavior. And so we again ask the question whether this information is actionable if we're able to detect it online. And it is when you look at these delays. So the length of these delays was not on the order of milliseconds or seconds. It was on the order of minutes or hours. So when you notice that this swap metric spikes, you have 3.5 hours. Is it what, 2.5? 3.5 hours. So that's like you see the swap metric spike, you get a page, you make dinner, maybe you have to go to the grocery store first, you eat your dinner, maybe come into work, chat by the water cooler, and you still have a couple of hours before this crash is going to occur. Okay. So how reliable is this prediction? So we did the following experiment. We used the first half of the log to give to our online analysis and say, do you find this correlation? It turns out it does. And we use that to set the threshold for this swap metric. So whenever the swap metric goes one standard deviation away from the norm, and it turns out it doesn't really matter where you set this threshold, it's very robust to this, then we'll raise an alarm. And then we use the second half of the log to test this. We said, OK, well, now if we let this play out with that alarm set, what do we see? It turns out there were 3 alarms raised during the second half of the log. And this was, there were no false positives and no false negatives. So every time an alarm went off, 3.5 hours later, roughly, the node would crash. And we never saw a crash that was not preceded by a spike in this metric. OK. So this is the sort of the concluding slide here. So what this work did was define influence as correlated surprise. And we implemented a scalable query tool and an online analysis for computing this in real systems. And we applied it to a variety of systems, including autonomous vehicles, clusters, supercomputers. And more recently, we've also applied it to non-computational systems. So we've been collaborating with a computational geographer, which I actually did not know was a thing until I met Harvey Miller from University of Utah. And we got some traffic data, and vehicle traffic data, which I guess I have to qualify in this crowd, from the state of Utah over about 10 years. And so we're using these exact same techniques to understand the behavior of traffic. Because that's a complex system. We can talk about traffic as anomaly signals. And all of these analyses are amenable to that sort of thing. And so hopefully I have demonstrated to you, at least in these examples, that there's some value in talking about and analyzing your systems using influence. And at this point, I'd love to take questions from you. Thanks.
There it goes. I'm Corey Leaning-Hainer from Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Hi.
Is the Qi code available for other people to use?
I'm perfectly happy to share it with you, but to be frank, it's research code. So it is not a polished tool, and that's the most generous way to put it. I'd be perfectly happy to share the code with you. I don't think you'd find it especially useful. The analysis is, especially the offline analysis, is not, I think, particularly difficult to implement. So, computing cross-correlation is very standard. The types of queries that we're computing are not, there's not a great deal of complex parsing going on. So I'd be happy to share the code with you. I think it may require a little more interaction than that for you to use it directly. But I would be enthusiastic to do that.
Excellent.
I think that for this community, this is Alvin Couch, Tufts University, I think for this community, the big issue is that this requires anomaly detectors on all sides. So I wanted you to comment just a little bit more on exactly what that anomaly detector does. Does it generate an event? Does it generate a state? What kind of output do you expect from the anomaly detector for this to work?
Right. So our notion of anomaly is not a binary concept. So you just talk about how surprising behavior is, and this is a sort of continuous notion. So you don't require for this that there be anomaly detectors all through your system. You simply need some mechanism for getting an anomaly signal from the raw measurements. So you can do that in a variety of different ways. You could either go to the source of where these measurements are being generated and actually have that happen there. You can wait until these logs are aggregated somewhere and compute anomaly signals once they've been aggregated. And we don't, as I said a few times, that we don't require anything fancy going on with this anomaly detection. In fact, if they're numerical metrics, you can just use them directly. So deviation from the mean is one way to specify sort of how surprised you are. So unusual things are surprising, if you like. But again, you can sort of make that as complicated as you're willing to. Right? Does that answer your question?
Sort of.
Okay.
I'll just second the source code. Even if it's not runnable code, I mean, those of us who sometimes put statistical wonk hats on, I'm really curious to see, you know, methodology, techniques, that kind
sure.
of thing. You know, anything that can be inferred, even if it doesn't compile for me, you know, it's ideas, you know.
Okay, hopefully it will compile.
I'm David Pullman from NIST. I was wondering, I think I saw this a little bit in the Stanford mail server category, where there really wasn't an anomaly detection process going on, but there seemed to be some, this is useful information, these relationships are being developed. So what I'm wondering is if this would be useful even where there are not failures occurring, but to establish there are relationship dependencies that are being seen there, and perhaps with the person, the experts that are involved, might be able to use this. And I was wondering if the useful part of it might have included this, where they can say, you know what, this relationship looks dangerous to me. I need to build some more robustness or redundancy in my system to make this a little bit better. I was wondering if you'd heard that.
So that's a very good point. And as you said, that this is exactly one of those cases. So when I said there are times when you may not have a specific question that you're trying to answer, this was one of those times in the sense that the mail server was basically behaving correctly. He ended up finding out that it wasn't behaving correctly as a consequence of looking at these relationships. But the way we got there was exactly that he noticed, for example, so there's this devnull.mail component that's in a clique along with these SMTP servers, and that seems to have this delayed influence that's pointing over to SMTP Roam. And so he looked at that and said, well, actually, I've been noticing that there was something interesting. So and that sort of led to this. So again, there was no, this is not like a relationship between, or correlations of failures. This is not correlations of when things output the wrong answer or anything like that. This is just correlations of deviations from average. So when surprising things seem to happen around the same time. So it's exactly as you said, it can elucidate shared influences and interactions that even the people very familiar with these systems may not have been aware of.
Another question is about how accurate clock timestamps have to be, because very often we have skewed systems where we're dealing with a great number of different clocks. So I'm wondering if you could comment a bit on how accurate clocks have to be in order to enable timing dependencies.
Right. So in one of our papers, we actually used this technique as a way of inferring clock skew. So if you have two components that you know should be strongly correlated in their behavior, then you simply compute the shared influence, look at the strength, the amount of that delay, and that implies that there is that's the quantity of the clock skew. So we tried doing exactly that with real systems. As far as how accurate do the timestamps need to be, in the process of doing these controlled simulations and adding timing noise, one of the things that we did exactly was that we would so we did one experiment where we just added Gaussian noise to the timestamps, and we did another experiment where we actually shifted en masse entire signals relative to each other.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily need the clock skew to be constant. This is a question from the audience.
That's right.
You can have the clock skew vary over time.
That's right. So what you'll see is that if you look at the cross-correlation functions, maybe a picture would be easiest. So if you look at the cross-correlation functions, if your timestamps are not very precise, then what you'll see is that these correlation peaks will be more spread out. And so the more noise that you add to the timestamps, the more smush this will get. And the danger is that if it's sufficiently bad, that this peak will sort of go below any kind of reasonable threshold. It would be smushed to oblivion, basically smushes everything out. The opposite of that is that you can have situations where the peaks are extremely well-defined when you have very precise delays. And so then you can be very confident about that being a correlation, right? So the correlation magnitude will be higher as well because you have it more regularly matches up at that delay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, great.
Hi. Hi. Great talk. Very impressive. The thing I'm thinking of is, so let's say you have a central syslog server, a server which has armies of machine reporting to them. Can you do implied component naming? Or do I have to go in and work out what all the components are that are in syslog? Like, so these are my SMTP logs, and these are this, and these are not. Can you look at a set of logs with different names and say, well, this component seems to be named X, because it means that kind of the ability to generate an automated set of these would be fantastic.
Right. So let me. I'll answer your question by telling you what we do when we get these logs. The administrator will say, "Here's a pile of files that are the logs for this system," mm-hmm. and if you look in the second column, that usually indicates what component generated it. And so from there, we'll infer the component that generated that particular log message and separate those out and get the anomalies from that. So I think that answers your question, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. If there's no regularity in terms of the naming, meaning that this name field could appear kind of anywhere in the message, then you need to provide it a little bit more information. There are tools for, Kathleen Fisher, for example, who's at sort of AT&T and Stanford, was doing work with PADS, which tries to infer the structure of messages and data like that, and so you could run that over it and say, are there any constant fields, or are there fields that seem to have take values that are a number approximately equal to the number of components in my system, or something like that, to try to guess at it.
It just seems like it would be a very interesting, even daily report, right? You've got a server with hundreds or whatever number of machines, and you have a database which contains, or a single store of all of your syslog, to be able to come in the morning and have it go, this component looks screwy on these boxes, or right. Variations on that. Just incredibly useful.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
So I'm actually kind of sort of responding to the previous question. Is one issue if you have this sort of central log server thing is that eventually, it's Garrett Wallman, MIT, you'll eventually have a lot of things suddenly coming into synchronization simply as a result of the fact that you're sending stuff over the network to a central place. And I wonder if that's going to confuse any of your correlation detection.
So that depends on where they're being timestamped. So it was the case, for example, in Stanley that messages were being timestamped both where locally where they were being generated and then again at the server that was collecting all of these logs in one place. So we tried doing the analysis with the sort of second timestamps. And what you get there is actually, so you said that it could be a source of imprecision. But it turns out that in Stanley, it was actually a way of us figuring out which components seem to have clock skew. So it was typically, in Stanley's case, very small. So it's a pretty well-integrated embedded system. But there were cases where the local timestamps would be consistently shifted by some small amount, even though they seem to be arriving at the server consistently around the same time.
Thanks.
Well, I'm starting to get this, but I want to make sure I've got the right idea, because I think that for this community, the term anomaly detection is a very strong thing. It seems that this one works even if it's interest detection, even if you're simply determining what's interesting and trying to find out how it's related. And so the word anomaly to us means things are going wrong, but it seems that this is much more highly applicable than that.
Yeah, I guess I mean it in the surprise sense. It was one of those things where, you know, I named it many years ago, and by the time I realized that certain communities had had deeply rooted emotions with that kind of term, it was far too late to rename it. But thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because I don't have a 22-node cluster to run this kind of cross-correlation on. Have you done any kind of optimization of the cross-products, any kind of transformations that make it maybe run on commercial hardware?
Sure. So you're asking whether the computation of cross-correlation itself, have we played with making that faster?
Right.
Right. So there are algorithms that will do things like you basically do the Fourier transform of the signal and then do your work in the frequency domain and then convert it back. And it turns out that that's sometimes faster and sometimes not. And it depends primarily on the length of the signals and the amount of skew that you want to look at. So those algorithms allow you to figure out the ones that convert to the frequency domain require you to do that for each of the shifts, basically, so you can't get these delay computations as easily. So it only is faster when you have extremely long signals and you're only interested in a very small amount of delay.
So if your timestamps are accurate and or you're willing to assume they are.
Well, it's not just about, you don't just get delay because of inaccuracies in timestamps. Sometimes you get delay because, in fact, the effects are delayed. Right. So there are some systems like Stanley where if you talk to the designers, they'll tell you, yeah, I mean, something that happened an hour ago is unlikely to affect anything that's happening now. So the turnover in the data is fast enough that it, you know, an hour ago is basically beyond our interest. Whereas a system like the SQL database where 3.5 hours later you're observing the consequences of something that happened then, clearly you need to look at a much longer delay. So if you have other ideas, we'd certainly be interested in talking with you. So we did try to obviously make the single core process fast and then make it parallel quickly and then also reduce the number of cross-correlations using the query language. So we had sort of these three levels of optimization. If anyone sees other opportunities, then I'd love to talk to you.
Hi, Ted Rodriguez-Bell with Wells Fargo. Do you know if something like this has been used in to research intrusion detection, you look essentially in real time for new correlations, since you don't know necessarily what the intruders are going to do, and you know, try to use that to find something you don't know about.
That's an excellent question. So in fact, I gave a talk 2 days ago at a conference called Trust, and previously had given a talk at a conference called RAID, where we published an application of looking for correlated surprise precisely to find epidemics in application communities. So the idea here was that we would, and I'll just quickly go here. So the idea was so you take anomaly signals that are representing the behavior of these individual components, and you compute the average and compare it against the threshold. And it turns out that computing the average of these is like computing the average of n independent identically distributed random variables. So you invoke the central limit theorem. And it turns out that even in practice, this gives you very reliable properties that differentiate infected communities from healthy communities. And so we have, in fact, done this. We've deployed it in a couple of places and used it to very good effect to reliably find when you're getting these intrusions. So we found this anomaly signal abstraction, as you mentioned, useful in security context also.
Wow, thank you.
So thank you. Got to give two talks today.
Without going into a great deal of detail, I was wondering if you could say where you're going next with this. Like what's the it's in research. I'm wondering if it's continuing and like what the goals are still to go.
Right. So the long-term vision is, so now what we've done here conceptually is we've said, what if these systems are immutable and whatever data they're generating, whatever instrumentation is there, that's what we have to work with in order to understand the behavior of these systems. And then so we develop all this analysis to sort of extract as much information from those instrumentation data as we can. But now I'm starting to kind of complete this loop and say, well, now that we have a little bit of better understanding, how do we then change the instrumentation on these systems? So can you ask questions like, is that log better than this other log for answering a particular question? What instrumentation is redundant? What instrumentation should I add? And even longer term, how should I design the system in the first place so that I can instrument it in such a way that I can get the answers to the types of questions that I'm going to want to answer once it's in production? All right. Oh, one more.
You haven't gotten this anywhere near any financial data yet, have you?
You know, ironically, the talk I gave 2 days ago at that conference was in the so-called financial infrastructures track. I don't know why. But the answer is no, we haven't done this with any financial infrastructure. Why do you ask? Do you have one and I could look at the logs? Before we stop, I just want to make sure that I acknowledge the fact that this work is absolutely impossible without the organizations that manage these machines signing off on sharing this data and the people who administer these machines working closely with me to evaluate whether it's actually doing anything useful. So a tremendous amount of other people's time has been spent on making this work. And so I just want to acknowledge them and thank them for all that they've done. And so these are organizations like Stanford and Sandia and Lawrence Livermore and the Stanford Racing Team and more recently Facebook and AT&T and University of Utah and so on. Okay, thanks.